This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Well, this Wednesday development was a bit unexpected.
The president has commuted the sentence of Alice Marie Johnson, a woman now in her 60s who was convicted in the late 1990s of drug possession and money laundering.
A life sentence to a first-time offender on a drug case. Yes, a commutation no-brainer, but one wonders how an African-American woman with a drug history would get on Donald Trump's radar to begin with.
Kim Kardashian, the reality TV star, was here at the White House to lobby the president last week for this commutation of sentence. Kim Kardashian just tweeting out best news ever to her legion of Twitter followers.
That's one mystery solved. The intervention of noted human rights advocate Kim Kardashian. But her timing was propitious because pardons have been very much on the president's mind, especially those of powerless, meek, remorseful victims of political persecution.
President Trump granting a full pardon to Dinesh D'Souza, the conservative author and filmmaker who pleaded guilty to campaign finance fraud.
He will be issued a pardon to the former top aide to Vice President Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby, who was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice in 2007.
President Donald Trump pardoning former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, recently convicted of criminal contempt for violating a judge's order. This was in a racial profiling case, and he continued to target immigrants at traffic stops.
And maybe this is all just a precursor to another pardon of another controversial elected official currently in the sights of prosecutors on any number of potential crimes.
Tweeting, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself. Even though I haven't done anything.
The president does seem to be taking to this pardon palooza. He's reportedly asking friends whom he can absolve next, while would-be applicants take to cable to plead their cases. The wife of George Papadopoulos, the former Trump campaign aide who pleaded guilty to lying about his Russia contacts, made the rounds this week.
I know how much dedicated and committed was in the Trump campaign. I know he did an excellent job, so I trust and hope and I ask to President Trump to pardon him. I hope he will.
It's also Trumpian, and yet, maybe, in its way, okay. Mark Osler is an expert on clemency policies and a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas. Albeit a far cry from presidential norms, he believes that Trump's style may actually be improving the way the clemency system works. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Presidential pardon derives from the ancient notion of clemency. Where does that notion come from?
From the very earliest legal systems. One of the things that I have that is a treasured possession is a Roman coin that's 1,700 years old that features their goddess Clemencia. They actually had a goddess of clemency. In the ancient world, clemency was a counterbalance to the harsh use of justice. It allowed the way that justice was meted out to maintain credibility because it had that aspect of mercy in it as well.
How did the framers intend for the power to be used?
There was an active debate about including this in the Constitution, as well one might imagine, because it's a rare thing. It's that presidential power in the Constitution that doesn't have a check or balance. The president can just pick up his pen and issue a pardon warrant. And from everything we know about this particular president, it probably shouldn't surprise us that that power of kings appeals to him.
Now, before Trump, presidential clemency was just as unchecked a power, but it was the subject to a number of more or less unspoken norms. Use the power sparingly, typically save your pardons to the end of your term, choose wisely lest you attract too much negative press and cloud your own legacy. How did this form of mercy come to be seen as a political risk?
Now, when we look back at Obama, at Bush, at Clinton, in the first 2 years, they didn't use clemency at all. But Ronald Reagan used it over 80 times in his first 2 years. Presidents before that tend to have it pretty evenly spread throughout their administration. It's really starting with Clinton that we see this notion that it's something to save to the end. And a lot of people will trace that to a development from the Dukakis-George H.W. Bush contest that a lot of us remember, the Willie Horton ad.
Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison.
That was an ad that Bush used against Dukakis involving a man that received a furlough in Massachusetts while Dukakis was governor.
Weekend prison passes, Dukakis on crime.
There were really troubling racial overtones to the use of that ad, but more than anything, it was seen as tipping the scales against Dukakis. The danger of having someone do something bad after you've released them really stilled the waters and prevented people from having the political will to use clemency the way it should be used.
Now, do you actually believe that Trump's way of going about things with respect to clemency is maybe an improvement over the norms that have been developing? Why do you believe that?
President Trump is ignoring the DOJ process. The way that clemency is supposed to work is that you file a petition to the pardon attorney, who's an official that's, you know, deep within the DOJ. Once the petition is filed there, it goes up to the Deputy Attorney General, over to the White House counsel, finally up to the president. That bureaucracy is unnecessary, and having it embedded within the Department of Justice is one of the biggest problems because of the obvious conflict of interest. Having prosecutors decide whether mercy is a worthwhile value in relation to the people where they sought the sentences, that's not the right people to be doing that.
The eradication of structural conflict is one reason you kind of like what Trump is up to, but there's a couple others.
Right now, we've got two systems side by side. One is the formal system that courses through the DOJ and the White House counsel, and we've got the informal system where a celebrity or Fox News makes a pitch directly to the president. The formal system isn't working. The informal system apparently is working. So let's formalize it and let's find a way to make it available to the people who are in prison who don't have that connection to celebrity.
In what way are the media part of the problem, and in what ways could we perhaps be part of the solution?
The media, like the rest of America, loves celebrities. And it's telling that when we read about the Alice Johnson commutation of her sentence, we read a lot about Kim Kardashian. We didn't read nearly as much about Alice Johnson, who she was, what she's done. And I can tell you, having worked on dozens of petitions for clemency pro bono for people across the country, their stories are just as compelling as any celebrities. These are people who grew up becoming a member of a gang at age 13, knowing nothing but that kind of life. Go to prison, they're serving a life sentence, and radically transform their life. Read a book for the first time, take hundreds of classes, and many of them are out there right now, people who received clemency under Obama, and there's hundreds more who are in prison. Those people who earned their redemption, the media needs to tell those stories too, not just the Dinesh D'Souza and the Joe Arpaios.
It is by now well documented that the president watches Fox News not only for talking points, but actual ideas. Is there not a risk that justice is subverted by just some really shrewd PR booking?
I'm not sure justice is subverted, but I do think it's unfair. And that's the thing that most urgently has to change. The president watches Fox News. He listens to celebrities. But we do have celebrities, and this includes Kim Kardashian, who are urging him to look more broadly. And hopefully that will lead him to a principle that will guide us to something that's more worthwhile.
Lead him to a principle?
I think Donald Trump can be led to a principle. You know, right now, it's interesting. Every time he grants clemency, he seems to use the same phrase, that this person has been treated very unfairly. The job of all of us is to convince this president that the pool of people who have been treated very unfairly is pretty extensive within our criminal justice system.
Now, as a man who almost every single day complains himself of having been treated unfairly, let's just say he is indicted and then chooses to pardon himself. Will that, do you think, in the end, pass constitutional muster?
Well, it depends on who's sitting on the Supreme Court at that time and what their view of expansive presidential power is. Right now, if we threw this to the Supreme Court, I think it's kind of a jump ball. And yeah, that's troubling. I hope he doesn't invite that constitutional crisis, but I fear that he will.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Osler is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas.
Coming up, why we are so very bad at policing Wall Street.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It might seem perverse to see a silver lining in Trump's pardoning spree, but justice of any kind can feel so distant these days. Take last week's revelation that Bush-era investigators had found Purdue Pharma to have concealed knowledge of OxyContin's abuse. Prosecutors wanted to indict for conspiracy to defraud, but the Bush Justice Department said, settle. The company ended up pleading guilty to, quote, misbranding and paid a fine. Whatever became of the perp walk and the fat cats in orange jumpsuits? In his new book, The Chicken Club, Pulitzer-winning journalist Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica says the DOJ has lost the incentive, the PR battle, and simply the will to prosecute white-collar crime. Jesse, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, the Chicken Club. Quite a title. Please explain.
So Jim Comey, long before he became FBI director and fired by Trump, was the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, the premier office for white-collar crime, for corporate law enforcement, particularly securities enforcement. In 2002, he came into this office and he gathers all the criminal prosecutors together. He says, "How many of you guys have never lost a case?" You have to understand these prosecutors, most of them are relatively young. They all came from elite law schools and got there by going in elite elementary schools on up. They had the best clerkships and they think of themselves as the best of the best of the best. Bunch of hands shoot up because they're so proud of their undefeated trial records. And Comey looks around the room and says, "Well, me and my buddies have a name for you. You're the Chicken Club. Your job is not about accumulating a unbeaten record, picking on little guys. Your job is about justice. And justice requires sometimes taking on the most ambitious cases and not being afraid of losing." And the argument of the book is over the subsequent 15, 16 years, the Department of Justice became the Chicken Club writ large.
Nice talk, son. But Comey's challenge didn't necessarily comport with even the most recent history of the government's behavior with white-collar crime. Politicians are all law and order about street crime, but historically, not so hard-nosed when the culprits are in dark suits.
Yes, there's never been a golden age where the wealthy and powerful had to fear for their liberty if they committed crime, but there have been silver ages and crackdowns throughout American history. After 1929, we create the securities laws that exist to today. That was a significant change. In the S&L crisis, we prosecuted over 1,000 individuals, including top executives from many of the top financial firms. We frog-marched a Goldman Sachs partner off the trading floor, which was a significant crackdown under Giuliani. In the late 1990s, early 2000, we had an accounting fraud pandemic and then prosecuted many of the top executives from many of the top companies that were implicated. So they were imperfect before, but the problem has become much more serious and acute now.
There have been hard-nosed prosecutors like Stanley Sporkin, who is one of your heroes, yet also accidentally kind of a villain. Let's start with why he's your hero.
He's the enforcement director at the Securities and Exchange Commission in the 1970s, policing all sorts of behavior that corporations had never had policed before. He had a great Columbo routine. He sat on this couch, and it was completely hideous. It was faded from some terrible colors from the early 60s, and he ate his lunch on that, and it would spew out Jell-O when he was talking. And defense lawyers would come in, very well-dressed, highly paid defense lawyers from the best firms, and they would make their arguments for their clients. And Sporkin would sit on this couch and sink into the cushions and appear to fall asleep. And they would be utterly discombobulated. They had no idea, should we go on with our presentations? Is he even listening? And then they would say something and he would spring up and he'd been listening the whole time and he would find a weakness in their argument and he would have them in his power then.
But one of his great tools, and this gets to his accidental villainy, was something we now know of as a consent decree. What was good about these things and what has gone wrong since?
He starts cracking down on an epidemic of corporate bribery, especially corporate bribery abroad, that was revealed in the Watergate investigation with slush funds. And what he does is brilliantly goes after them for not fully disclosing their bribes to the shareholders. They don't have a line item for bribery.
When we looked into these funds, we found out they were not only being used domestically in the United States for illegal campaign contributions, but being used to bribe officials overseas in connection with the company's business.
So he leveraged this to say, cooperate, pay a fine, then don't do it again. And lots of companies did. And he cleaned up corporate behavior, at least for a while. So in the hands of Sporkin, who was genuinely tough and clear-sighted, this new tool was good. Over time, it became corrupted. It became the kind of thing that they reached for without even thinking about it. And that's corrosive. At some point, people just think that paying fines to the SEC is a cost of doing business.
But an even more profound inflection point, you say, is the famed investigation and prosecution of Enron and of its accounting firm, Arthur Andersen, which you describe in rather thrilling detail. But they were successful prosecutions, weren't they?
Right. It's the high point and the beginning of the end for the Department of Justice. The Enron prosecutions were done the right way. They gathered a SWAT team of specialized prosecutors, locked them in a room, figuratively, then focused solely on that case, the energy trader that was undone by accounting fraud and its enabler, Arthur Andersen. They had destroyed literally tons of documents related to the Enron audit, clearly trying to cover up all their knowledge of it. So the Department of Justice wins its trial against Arthur Andersen. And then over time, the PR campaign, aided by the Wall Street Journal editorial page, the American Bar Association, even the ACLU, they succeed in changing the conversation from Arthur Andersen's accounting fraud and obstruction of justice to the innocent employees who have lost their jobs.
And it could mean the end of Andersen Accounting, which has already lost scores of clients and has already been forced to throw thousands of workers into the street.
Now the government is punishing everyone at the company.
They're being punished due to a couple of people that made some wrong decisions.
It's an amazing PR victory. And it's so effective that it's internalized by prosecutors themselves, and not just Republican laissez-faire prosecutors, but by Democrats. And by the middle of the aughts, people like Mary Jo White, who was the U.S. attorney in the Southern District, then becomes a corporate defense lawyer, then becomes Obama's head of the SEC before going back to her firm to become a corporate defense lawyer. She is saying Arthur Andersen was a mistake. And the head of the criminal division of Obama's Department of Justice, Lanny Brewer, is saying prosecuting Arthur Andersen was a mistake. They have decided that we can never prosecute large companies again. There are too many malign collateral consequences. And this is a disastrous conclusion.
All right. So counterintuitively, populist anger is inflamed about the government's pursuit of that group formerly known as Fat Cats. That's one incentive for prosecutors and regulators to pull punches. The other, to which you just alluded, is that revolving door between the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission and the defense bar. Your implication is that prosecutors were either going easy on pals or feathering their nests for later employment. But isn't the opposite also actually true, that the most successful prosecutors are the ones who are most valued when they do go into private practice?
This is the line that you hear from the Department of Justice and from the white-collar bar all the time, that prosecutors have every incentive to win a high-profile trial, but it's just not actually the case. What they do instead is they take on tangential cases. You can do a high-profile insider trading case at a hedge fund, and you're not taking on a systemic issue, and you're not taking on an institution that jeopardizes tens of thousands of people's jobs, but you still can get that stipple drawing on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and parlay that into a multi-million dollar partnership. But what's really going on at the Department of Justice now, in the dirty little secret of corporate law enforcement, is that we've outsourced and privatized it to the companies themselves. What happens is companies hire major law firms and they conduct internal investigations. And the internal investigations are delivered to the Department of Justice, and they look professional and dazzling and they're very thorough, but they're studiously incurious about culpability at the top. Not all of them, but many of them. It's akin to asking Donald Trump to investigate himself, and Donald Trump hires Rudy Giuliani and his firm to investigate the question. I mean, does anybody think that that's a regime that's going to result in the answer? I don't think so.
All right. So you're suggesting there has been this ideological shift in this century, but aren't you leaving a couple things out? One is that after 9/11, the Justice Department took all its attention from white-collar crime and organized crime, by the way, to focus on counterterrorism. And maybe more importantly, after the Wall Street crash, President Obama explicitly stated that he would put the liquidity of markets and the preservation of the fragile global banking system ahead of chasing the bad guys.
There will be time to punish those who set this fire, but now's not the time to argue about how it got set, or did the neighbor sleep in his bed or leave the stove on. Right now, we want to put out that fire.
I think this was one of the great scandals of the Obama administration, that they did not put more resources to prosecuting individuals after the financial crisis, because you could save the system and still prosecute the frauds. And in fact, they go hand in hand. To have legitimacy in saving the system and lend legitimacy to your reform efforts, you needed to say, we also held bad people accountable. Instead, what we did with bankers after the financial crisis is let most of them preserve their bank accounts, kept many of the top executives in their jobs at the biggest banks that they had just blown up, and now they're retiring to accolades. And the average person can look around and say, that is an outrage, and those guys are getting away with it, and you can't argue with them.
Your head must be swimming now that what meager financial regulations were imposed after the 2008 meltdown are now being deregulated again.
I mean, it's stunning that we would have such a short-term memory loss. And the point of the book is that this problem was building before the financial crisis, and it persists to today. And it affects not just big banks, but all sorts of companies, industrials, pharmaceuticals, tech. And it will lead to another grave financial crisis. I don't know when, but it's inevitable.
Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jesse Eisinger is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for ProPublica and author of the magnificently titled The Chicken Club.
Coming up, what it's like to be one of the greatest reporters who ever lived, and a legendary pain in the butt.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Just a heads up, there are ethnic slurs, quotes from a policeman and a president, in the next segment. Seymour Hersh is famous for consequential scoops, from exposing the massacre of Vietnamese civilians in My Lai to CIA surveillance to the torture of Iraqis in Abu Ghraib. Most recently, he's the author of Reporter, a memoir. He's also a twin, and once when asked by the parent of twins what it's like to be one, he replied, "It's great! I won."
I have twin sisters, too. He's a physicist from UC, California, but he's got a specialty in wave theory. Mm-hmm. And here's the story about America. There was a program called, you got a second?
Sure.
Deep Sea Submergence Program. It was run out of Hawaii undercover. It was one of the biggest secret programs in the government. People who knew wave theory, noise underwater, my brother's expertise, would monitor Russian submarines. So a new submarine would come out, and we'd pick up the sound of the engine, and there were people that would translate this to know where every Russian submarine, particularly the boomers, the one with nuclear weapons, were at any time. My brother was brought into that program to help him. And in the 70s, when he got in, I was writing about the program and exposing all the stupid things they were doing. And he said, about 1990 or so, you know, he said, I was in a very secret program.
And you didn't know your brother was in it?
No, no, he didn't tell me because it was very top secret. He said, you have no idea the trouble you caused me. Every year I had to take a lie detector test. When it was all over, the guy said to me, you know, your brother's a real asshole. And I thought to myself, what a nice story about America.
It is.
They didn't ever suspect him of talking to me.
As you describe in the memoir, he was the one who was allowed to go off and pursue the sciences until he graduated. You were going to take care of your mom. Your father had died. Took over your father's dry cleaning business. Then you worked in a liquor store. You did a bit of flailing around. But there was an intervention.
What happened was, back in the 1950s, in high school, in my third year, my father got cancer. My father had a business, a ghetto business, laundry and cleaning, a small shop that kept the family going. My parents were both Eastern European, didn't talk much. There was not much communications. I had some tests that I took in the beginning of my fourth year, and there were three of us who did well, and one went to Harvard. I think they both ended up there, and I went nowhere. I barely could graduate. I was just running my father's business and being horribly depressed. My father was dying. Mm-hmm. And so there's a local two-year junior college in Chicago that was run by the University of Illinois. Guys came back from the war, and they were working, and they wanted to be educated, but they couldn't afford to go to the main campus in Champaign, Urbana, 150 miles away. So they set up a two-year program, a junior college, in an old Navy barracks that they had built into Lake Michigan. I went to school there, and I go to this class, and I wrote a paper, and the guy who was teaching had just gotten his doctorate at Chicago, turned in the paper, and a week later, at the end of class, he said, "Is Seymour Hersh here?" So I walked up thinking, like, 99% of the kids in the world, what had I done wrong? And he said, "What are you doing here?" I began to mumble something. My father got sick, blah, blah, blah. And I was 18. Mm-hmm. He said, "Meet me at the University of Chicago admissions office in 2 days. And I did. And the next thing I know, I'm going to this wonderful university. What makes it, to me, very emotional is I forgot all that. I go on with life. I get to be a big deal. 1983, I write a book about Kissinger. And my wife was going through mail, and she opened this letter. It was from the professor. And it began by saying, "You probably don't remember me, but I've intervened twice in all my years of teaching, and one of them became a neurosurgeon, and the other one was you." And I began to cry, because I suddenly remembered that moment. What are you doing here? And it happened again and again in my career. People saw things in me early on that I didn't think I had.
And your first stop in journalism, City News, the place that you say Ben Hecht based the front page on?
Right.
You said you were smitten, but you observed that, and I quote you, "the ambitious young reporters working the courthouses and the police beats understood their mission was to live within the system and somehow make the city work." That's awful.
It was tyranny. It was a police and mob tyranny. I came there as a copy boy, but I was clearly smart and interesting to some of the editors. I was a little mouthy too, but so what? They got me to the street. I got into central police, and you have to understand, I'm suddenly free. I suddenly am not running this dinky store that was crazy. You know, I was on my own. I could actually do something. This job saved me. I fell into it. But after being a cop reporter for about 3 or 4 months, there was a killing in the middle of the night. And two cops radioed in that somebody tried to escape and they had to shoot him. And I was in Central Police overnight. Most of the time it was quiet and we smoked the dope the cops had. But sometimes you have a lot of action. And there was a killing. A cop had shot somebody. So I wanted to see the guys when they drove in to the parking lot. And so I get down, and just as these two beefy, red, typical Chicago cops pull in, and one of their other buddies says, "Hey, Mick, so that guy tried to escape and you had to shoot him." He said, "Nah," he said, "I told the nigga to run and I shot him. I heard it." And so I call my editor. "I can't believe what I just heard. And I've got the license number." He said, "Don't touch it." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "It's your word against theirs. You're going to have to be off that beat if you do that. And you may have to leave the reporting business." So I went a couple of days later and I looked up the coroner's report. Sure enough, 3 bullets in the back. And I tried again to go pursue the story. The editor said, "You don't understand. You're not going to do that story."
What lesson did you take from that?
Oh, a big lesson. That the business I adored so much was full of self-censorship and compromise. And so was I. And I maybe hate self-censorship.
We've previously discussed My Lai at length, and we'll link to that interview again. But you told us that when you went after that story, which was about the massacre by U.S. troops of every last man, woman, and child in a North Vietnamese village, in this case, how much were you pushed by a thirst for justice and how much by hunger for a blockbuster scoop?
I didn't know what I was getting into until I began to get into it. I didn't realize how grotesque it was. GIs going into a village of 500 people or more, thinking there might be an enemy there, seeing no enemy, just going and killing everybody, thinking that's the orders, throwing babies in the air and catching them on bayonets. During the killing, as we all know, they stopped and ate their lunch by the ditch in which they'd shot people. None of that was known to me.
Yeah.
Of course, the thought I had when I began to get close to the story and found Callie and found his lawyer, I had two muddled thoughts. One was fame, fortune, and glory. And the other one is that, God, maybe we can do something to stop this war.
When you were working in Washington, which in many ways was a fraught period, there were early episodes that opened your eyes to the fact that people will lie bald-faced.
One of the things that happened with the Pentagon, it was very hard to report on the Vietnam War because you had to sign in at every office you went to. So if you got something really good from somebody, you had to spend 2 days talking to other generals.
Just to muddy the waters.
Make it harder for them. If there were more than 5 or 6 people, they wouldn't search you out. And so Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times had gone to Hanoi, the first reporter allowed in years in 1966, and over Christmas of 65, 66. And he was filing dispatches to the Times that talked about bombing that we didn't know anything about, bombing the hell out of the North, and a lot of bombs missing their target. I was writing propaganda as the AP correspondent, and over Christmas there was a little...
You were writing propaganda?
Well, of course, I was getting the briefings.
Did you know you were writing propaganda?
I don't know what you think Pentagon correspondents do for a living, but I will tell you that inevitably, if you're covering a beat and it involves the Pentagon or the CIA, you're writing propaganda. But I wrote some very aggressive stuff, and over Christmas, there was a cocktail party for the press, and everybody's being nice, and McNamara had been lying about bombing. I'd gotten to some admirals and generals who were telling me the truth. And so I broke the rules. I said, "Tell me about the bombing, Mr. Secretary." He had worked on the study of the bombing after World War II, a special commission. He was an officer. He wrote papers that talked about how bad the bombing was. And he laughed and he said, "Yes, it's true. Bombings never go where they go." And everybody laughed and I was enraged.
This was at a cocktail party.
Well, I was off the record. So I wrote a piece about it under a pseudonym for them, for a very gutsy weekly, the National Catholic Reporter, that was a brilliant paper. I wrote a piece about McNamara with his arrogance, and they put it all over page one. You know, I was a marked man, and deservedly so. I broke the rules.
You wrote that when Robert McNamara's senior press aide retired in 1967, he spent 6 years screaming at reporters who got out of line. A guy named Arthur
Sylvester. Right.
He wrote this. It's on page 62. "For 6 years, I watched cover stories promulgated by his own office go down as smooth as cream when I thought they would cause a frightful gargle. In other words, he had contempt for the press corps for swallowing the garbage that he was dishing out day by day.
It's an amazing clip. You know, one of the things about doing a memoir is you think your memory is good, and the first thing you learn is it's terrible. That was an essay in Saturday Evening Post or something.
It's a devastating indictment.
That's what I thought. But the coverage of the war from Washington was awful.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible. When I got hired by the New York Times, it was by Abe Rosenthal, with whom I tangled so much.
The stories in the book about that relationship.
Oh, my.
You had legendary scoops at the time about CIA surveillance, about Watergate. You always got space on the front page, well, almost every time. And there's an incredible story about you waking up the Times managing editor, Abe Rosenthal, in the wee small hours under very awkward circumstances.
You know, despite my fighting with Abe, and it was constant, he did trust me. So they hired me to go to Washington and do stuff on the war. And I learned in early 1972 there was some horrible secret inside the CIA involving criminal activity in America. There was a subsequent study done by the CIA itself, all full of stuff about how they were watching me for 2 years. I hadn't told anybody about the domestic spying story. I knew there was something there. It took a long time. Finally, December the 20th, 1974, I see the head of the CIA, William Colby, in his office about 9:30 in the morning, and I say, okay, you wiretapped this guy, and you did this, and you did all these operations domestically. And what Colby did is he never said no. He would say, no, we didn't do 150 wiretaps of reporters. We only did about 30. And I think he thought that was okay, but I knew he was in trouble. I could do this story. And this is a story actually about a reporter and an editor. I called Abe up from a payphone on Route 123 outside of the CIA and said that the CIA has been spying on American citizens. He said, what? I said, yeah. He said, well, go write it. And so I went to the office and I started writing. Abe had told the Sunday editor, a guy named Ev Jenkins, Hearst is going to have a story. So they saved 2,500 words, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 o'clock or 2:30 in the morning, I'm in the office. I'm alone. I love being alone at night in the big newsroom.
And you were about at word 7,000 at that
point. I was at word 5, but it was going to go that much. It was going to be a whole page. The guy making up the Sunday paper, Jenkins, says, what are you doing, Si? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you've written 4,000 or 5,000 words. Abe told me about 2 or 3 columns. The paper's all made up. We know you're doing a story. We've got space out on page 1. Maybe I can get another 500 words for you. I said, what? I said, okay, hang up. I don't socialize with editors. I just don't, never did, and I don't like to. I mean, they're nice people, you know, but, you know, I'd rather have a rabbit as a friend. Anyway, in the editor's desk, I found the home phone number for Abe, and it rings about 7, 8 times.
Because this is 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah, so what? Somebody wrote a review and he said, he's so self-obsessed. Are you kidding? I've got a story about domestic spying.
So I'm just saying that's why it rang so long.
And so at the time, his wife's name was Ann. I'd met her once. I said, Ann, just blah, 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 blah. I got to wake him up. She said, what? I said, Ann, I got to wake him up. She said, well, go find the unpleasant words he said about the woman he's sleeping with and hung up. And I thought to myself, oh, my God. God, I'm in the middle of a soap opera. But I called back, and she answered in the third, what, she said. I said, tell me who the lady is. I got to find Abe. It's about a story that you'll be glad you helped. Long silence, and she gave me the name. It was somebody who was in public life who was enlisted. I then had to call one of my agents up and get them to get an unlisted phone number, and I then called her.
So now it's about 3 in the morning.
Yeah, well...
I can't believe you called back Ann Rosenthal.
I called back. And I said, you've been a reporter's wife for 25 years. You know the business. I need him. There's a story that's important about wrongdoing by the government, and I know you'd want the story to be published. And so she helped me. And so I found this person, and I called him. I had one of those cutoffs after 5 rings.
Mm-hmm.
I called again, and finally she answered. And I said, look, lady, just wake him up. I beg your pardon. I said, just tell him Cy Hirsch is on the phone and I'm going to go blow up the f***ing news. A minute later, he says, are you crazy? I go, blah, 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 blah. And he says, hang up. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. I hung up. I'm running around, pacing, jumping up. And 5 minutes later, he calls and he says, okay, whatever he called me, numbskull or whatever it was, here's what's going to happen. 1.6 million editions of the New York Times tomorrow. You're going to have a house set on one side and your cockamamie, I remember that word, story on the other side. You happy? I said, yes, now. If you ever tell anything about what happened tonight, he said, I will come and beat the hell, whatever he said. And I waited till he died. He'd been dead for 10 years and wrote it. I thought, what the hell? But here's what's important. It's a 7,000-word story burying the CIA. More, 7,500 words. Stayed writing until about 7, kind of 12. They had an edit. There was concern about the word. I used the word massive, and we agreed that there was 100,000 files I knew about. That's massive on American citizens. The sourcing was A+. Anyway, the New York Times ran a story burying the CIA, led to the church hearing, led to the first formal investigation, led to the establishment of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, which has been ruined now by partisanship, mm-hmm. but led to incredibly good change. They ran that story, and it was a sole matter of trust between Abe Rosenthal and me. I did that story, and he didn't know about it for 2 days in advance, even though the CIA had known about it for 2 years. And it didn't matter. The trust was there.
But let's talk about when and how that happens, because what I gathered from your book is that it was much easier to expose the wrongdoing of public institutions than of powerful people who are close to reporters. And Bill Kovich, a colleague of yours in 73 who went on to become the Washington bureau chief, explained years later to the Washington Post that one of the biggest problems he had as an editor was, quote, managing Psy at a newspaper that hated to be beaten but didn't really want to be first. So you got the CIA surveillance story out, but evidently, frequently, it played out differently.
Yes. Well, later it did at the New York Times. What happened is later I picked up a freelance writer named Jeff Girth, who was a wonderful journalist who had a great career at the Times. I was doing stuff on organized crime. I was living in New York then, and I went after a big corporation, mm-hmm. Gulf and Western, run by a guy named Charlie Bluedorn, who was a very good friend, apparently, of the publisher. He owned Paramount Movies, and he used to show movies in advance to all the editors, all the powerful people in town. The New York Times just did not want to take on big business. They were squeezed by me. To their credit, they ran 4 stories that I and Jeff did on page 1 about Gulf and Western. But
the editing, they were denuded of all style, of all anonymous quotes.
It was the worst experience I had. The hardest reporting in the world is to do a corporation, because it turned out later, as I did this book, during the research, the New York Public Library has all of Rosenthal's papers. And there was all these letters that Gulf and Western had written about me and what I and Girth were doing and saying.
To discredit you.
But they never shared them to me.
Yeah.
The editors never gave me a chance to answer that. I don't know what they believed or didn't believe. And I left and went on to write books. But it was a terrible time. It was a year of purgatory. The stories were so beaten down, they were incomprehensible, I thought.
You know, it's funny, despite all the Sturm und Drang you went through in Washington, even before you got to New York, you told Bob Thompson of the Washington Post that those years in Washington, there'll never be a period like that in our business again. Nobody can understand what it was like. Boy, wake up. Boy, hear story. Boy, get story. Boy, put story in paper. No trauma.
I said something else I decided not to put in the book.
What was that?
It was over Gulf and Western or even the Korshak. I did a series on a gangster called Korshak. Boy, wake up. Boy, get story. Boy, get edited. Boy, get tortured. Boy, throw typewriter through window. Boy, go home. Boy, come back. Window fixed. Typewriter back in his desk. Nobody says anything.
And that's true.
It was awful.
There are many lessons here for journalists or would-be journalists. But there was something I found really illuminating when you were describing what you called the Wicker moment, and then the moment that you had that revealed the character of powerful people.
Well, Tom Wicker was this wonderful, wonderful journalist. And in 73 or 74, I was pounding away like everybody else. And so I received the transcript. At that time, Nixon transcripts were not made public, but they were using the White House taping system. Once the government learned about it, they used it to prosecute people. I got a transcript of Nixon just using every vile term he could for minorities, Italians and Polish people and Jewish people in particular. So we told the White House in advance we were going to write this story about using terms like spick and kike. There was a lot of angst about it. Mm-hmm. The White House, the press apparatus, there was a lot of attacks on me and the Times. The whole context of what he did raises serious questions about this president's, who in the hell is he? What kind of a person mm-hmm. is he to talk this way in private? And so while this was going on, it was back and forth, Tom Wicker, who was then the columnist. And remember, when I was at the Times, Tony Lewis was a columnist. So you had Russell Baker using fey, sardonic language to make wonderful points. Mm-hmm. Instead of this constant drumbeat we have, the you know, of Trump's so dumb, Trump's so dumb. But we had Tom Wicker writing great columns. Anyway, mm-hmm. he slid up next to me and he said, I want to tell you a story that's been tormenting me. In 65, when Johnson began to expand the war in Vietnam, every Friday they were, in the summer, they'd fly down to the ranch, you know, in Texas, this huge ranch that he had. And one Friday before he left, he filed a story raising a lot of questions about the conduct of the war. In those days, the Times would fly the Saturday newspaper down to the ranch. And so in the morning, everybody saw the story, and Tom's column was fronted. It was on page one. And there was a morning briefing they had around 10:30. George Reedy was the press secretary then, I think. He was saying to everybody that the lid is on, which meant go mm-hmm. play some golf or
no
go play tennis.
No news will be made today.
No news. Johnson had a white Cadillac convertible. And all of a sudden, here comes the Lincoln convertible at high speed, blowing dirt all over on a dirt road, slams on the brakes right in front of the press group, opens the passenger door, calls out Wicker. And Wicker looks at him and he crooks his finger. So Wicker walks and he gets into the car. Johnson says nothing. They drive off for, you know, 50, 60 miles an hour. And he stops by some bushes and puts on the emergency brake, walks behind some bushes and bends down and defecates. Tom can see this, wipes himself with leaves, comes back, gets in the car, turns around, doesn't say a word, speeds like hell back to where the press is still there, sort of wondering what's going on, stops, leans over, open the door, give a little motion, get out. Tom said, here's why I'm talking to you. I knew then, in this visceral way, that the war was going to continue no matter what, and that he was going to kill a lot more people, that he was crazy when it came to that war. And he said, I didn't know whether to tell that story or not, and I never did. So I'm glad you wrote the story about what Nixon said about Jews and Italians, WAPs, and kikes and Polacks. I'm glad you did that. That was his message. We already were building up the war. We had 300,000 people, but the real casualties didn't come. There were 2,000 a week, and by 67, 68. In 68, there were some months where you had 10,000 a month killed. But the underlying message to me that left me chilled was he knew something then, viscerally, mm-hmm. that must have haunted him.
Well, you see, that's just it. Nixon, in employing that language, his office said, oh, well, it was affectionate, it was a joke, but it was crazy. And what Johnson did was crazy.
Yes.
And let's talk about Trump just briefly. A great deal of ink has been spilled over his administration's treatment of the media, specifically the lies, whether the press does enough to push back. Do we see an endless stream of Wicker moments, or is this something else?
One thing you can say is what you see is what you've got. You're not going to find private tapes in which he says something differently.
Mm-hmm.
My worry about what's going on is I watched the polls. He's gone up maybe 7-8 points. That's 20% since the beating up got more intense.
The press beating up on him.
And I don't know if he's maybe smarter than we think. He's controlling the agenda totally, totally. He attacks now and the FBI is out to get me. Whatever it is, it just doesn't end the coverage. I look at the cable news and I just think, oh, have we really come to this? that if I'm in the New York Times, I get a tip on a story, a tip becomes a story, and then I put it online for the Times, and then I go on, you know, MSNBC that night to talk about it. I can't relate to what's going on. A lot of tips and a lot of secondhand stuff is being run as serious stories, even in the good newspapers. And that's the meaning. If Putin says, I want to see you, he may go see Putin. What are you going to do, attack him on that forever? What if he takes out 28,000 troops from South Korea? We have that many, or 26,000, and saves us a couple of $1 billion a year. Is that bad? He may be a circuit breaker. I'm just saying, pick your fights, that's all. Giuliani ranting and raving should be ignored. I wouldn't pay much attention to that. I wouldn't pay much attention to the Daily. I would go all over every cabinet member. The Times and Post are doing Pruitt. I would do them all. I would do over decisions made. I would do over how things work. A daily story about some child taken away from his mother on the Mexican border. I would just do that. It's so friggin' insane. I would talk to experts who would tell you how horrible that's going to be. You're creating monsters when you do that. You know, damage that's just incomprehensible. Okay, you got my lecture. More than you want. Goodbye. I got to go.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
After 90 minutes, he ran away. Seymour Hersh is the author of Reporter, a memoir. In the next few days, you'll be able to hear a longer version of our talk at onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leah Feder. We had more help from Meg Harney, and our show was edited by Brooke.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.